Okay, so I'm Rick Hampson. This is Train Your Brain. This is, I think, number 19, and the next to last one we're going to do. Today is August 12th, 2008. And the Train Your Brain course, so I'm a psychologist and a writer and a teacher. And so the Train Your Brain course was started, for those of you that don't know, probably a lot of you do know, as a way to use science about the brain, somewhat informed by thousands of years of contemplative practice, and then translate that into real tools people can use in daily life. So that's the genesis of the course. And it's offered by the nonprofit Wellspring Institute, which I founded with my buddy Rick Mendias, who is normally here tonight. Rick's a neurologist, and yet the sly dog is getting married. So he's in the East Coast with Shelley. And I don't actually recall the exact date of their wedding. It's Vedic astrologically ordained, because Shelley is neck deep in that stuff, okay, while also being a serious psychologist and academic. But anyway, so they're over there east. Anyway, whatever that is. And so I'm flying solo tonight. So anyway, we founded the course. It's a very straightforward course. The money part's very simple. It's pure donation. Whatever you want, whatever you give is very, very gratefully received. People always ask what to donate. I say, I don't know. A banana, chocolate, money, it's up to you. The donations basket is out there if you want to do that. It helps pay for the room and keep the Institute going. I don't take any money for this, nor does Rick. It's a labor of love for us. And it's also consistent with our tradition, which is predominantly Buddhist, or primarily Buddhist, I should say, in which teachings are always freely given. It's not an exchange. You know, they're freely given, and any form of appreciation is freely given as well, ideally as a form of personal practice, because it makes you happy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the money part. That's easy. Logistically, it's also easy. We'll take an official break in about an hour. The bathrooms are out there, men and women. We will... it's always okay to get up and get some water, coffee, or tea along the way. And I also apologize for apparently some glitches in the directions. We use the hotel's directions, and we discovered that the second green awning actually is another Enterprise rent-a-car awning. So you fool me, and I'm teaching tonight. So and I went all the way around, and then I found this place, and I was good to go. Now, temperature-wise, I'm thinking about leaving that back air conditioner on if it doesn't blast you guys. It's too loud. We'll leave it off. And yeah, okay.
But if we need to turn on, it's great.
Yeah, that's right. And I can always speak loudly. So we're experimenting with this room. The Unitarian Church would be 10 times hotter tonight than this is, so we figured, well, let's give it a crack. Okay, so I think that's the official start. Tonight is about relationships. And in basically about 2 hours, I want to pack much of what I know about relationships from a long marriage and a lot of other relationships and a long history as a therapist and couples counselor. And we are going to focus on one key dimension in relationships, which is emotional joining. If you really think about it in life, there are basically two fundamental dimensions that encompass most everything: autonomy and intimacy. A lot of stuff can be placed under those two headings. And both are really vital. And interestingly, they serve each other. It's when we feel truly autonomous, truly able to be wholly ourselves, that we can really enter into intimacy with another person and relax into it and give way into it and be wide open to the heavy winds that sometimes blow when you're really close to another person, right? Flip the other way, it's because we get refueled in relationships in many ways, and we discover in part who we are. We're deeply social animals. We're the most social animal on the planet, if you think about it, in terms of actual nuances and layering of behavior. And a very large part of the brain development that distinguishes us from our primate relatives, as well as the other creatures that walk the earth, a lot of that brain development has been driven by relationship skills, by learning how to pair bond, by empathy and cooperation in tribal groups of various kinds. So relationships are really central. So we get fed in relationships. That enables us to go out into the world, our secure base, which I'll talk more about tonight, to go out and be really autonomous. So you see, so they go together really well. So we're going to focus a lot, though, on allowing closeness to occur, and we will therefore have to also talk about the that also comes up the closer you get. It reminds me a little bit of magnets. You know, when you're a kid, you bring them together, but when you bring the same poles together, like north-north, the closer you get, the repulsive force increases sort of as the square of the distance or some craziness, whatever that is. Anyway, there are issues that we all have about feeling close, because it's very often in moments of feeling close that we feel most hurt. Moments of most greatest vulnerability, greatest dependency, particularly in early childhood, that the greatest owies, you know, came down, the greatest stabs to the heart. And so those patterns are very learned. We're the learning animal. We learn those patterns. No surprise, we enact those patterns. We have those patterns in adult relationships, too. So we're going to explore all that. And we're going to do a certain amount of me sharing with you what I have found to be personally extremely valuable kind of roadmaps of relationships, or ways of doing pattern recognition in relationships that summarizes a lot of material. So you suddenly realize, you see yourself, oh, this is the script I'm caught in. And as soon as you recognize the movie, it's like if you didn't know what kind of movie you were watching, and suddenly Bruce Willis comes out and he shoots somebody, you go, okay, I know this movie. The details change, or it's a different kind of movie, and suddenly you hear the sound of a chainsaw in the background. I don't know. You know that kind of movie, right? It's a different kind of movie. It really helps to know what sort of movie you're in. Okay? So that's what we're going to do tonight. And so, in particular, I'm going to focus on relationship patterns in important relationships, high-stakes relationships. Very often those are intimate relationships, but they could also be an important relationship at work. It could be a family relationship, parent-child. Tonight, you might want to just kind of open wide and reflect on a lot of relationships in your life. You could also, in particular, pick a relationship, because I'm going to present a lot of information to you. We have pads out there if you want to take notes. We'll also post this talk on our website for free download, so you can go back and download it to your computer and then do with it what you want, including sticking it on your iPod, whatnot. But my point is, it might serve you well to pick one relationship that you keep coming back to and examining through the various lenses that we'll go through tonight. Okay, great. A little caution. This is not therapy. This is not the S training. I've done both. And more. So take good care of yourself. It's not my intent to blow you out of the water. On the other hand, I'm going for it tonight. And take good care of yourself. We will do some exercises. They're designed to be fairly gentle, but you can take them deeper if you want. So that's really up to you. Or take them more deeply, I guess. That's really up to you. But just take care of yourself. Okay, great. Okay. Any quick comments, questions? Right on time, amazing. All right, great. I should also say that for me, it's bittersweet and mostly sweet that this is the second to last Train Your Brain. It's great. It's been a great run, great people. It's been a complete privilege for me. I know I speak for Rick as well, to meet all the people here. A few for the first time, but mostly are regulars. And it's just been great. What a sweet run. And we're not done with all this stuff. We just have to write a book and about 10 other things in a short amount of time. So we'll come back at this, I think, down the road in a different way, perhaps. Maybe in the form of telecourses, perhaps, I don't know. Okay, so thank you for being here, really. I'm trying to cry. That's it. Okay, so let's see. So now I'm going to talk about relationship paradigms. And I'm going to allow myself to use some of the straight-out clinical, even academic language. I'm not going to dumb it down. And I really, on the other hand, for me, this is not ivory tower abstract stuff. They're talking about my childhood. You know, it's like, you know, you're reading the real deal when you read like a page in graduate school, some textbook, and you go, whoa, and you're upset for the rest of the night. You know, you read something that was like, wow, that's my childhood. Wow. Yeah. Or that's, wow, that's the 3 years I blew in my 20s. Wow. You know, like real. Okay, so I encourage you to relate to it that way. Keep making it personal. And if it's not personal for you, raise your hand. And I won't therapize with you, but I want to make it personal for you. Okay, so here we go. So first off, a biological framework. Like I said earlier, we're highly social animals. I think it's really important to keep coming back to our animal nature. I mean, it's useful that to realize that our DNA is 98% identical, more or less, to that of a chimpanzee. And it's also important to realize that most of that 2%, it's really closer to, it's kind of 1% to 2%, depending on how you slice it, the molecule, most of that codes for social functions. It codes for social intelligence functions, empathy, social processing, theory of mind, reading the state of mind and the intentions of other creatures, doing that rapidly and on the fly, recognizing facial expressions, forming a sense of self, autonomy, in the domain of relationships, remaining I in a frame of we, et cetera, et cetera. So, that's the framework in which I'm going to be talking tonight. And on the other hand, it's really important to realize that, evolution gives us tendencies and inclinations. These days, there's a lot of, I think, overstatement of the impact of genetics and heredity and biology, partly because we're a quick fix culture, and that goes right to the quick fix of some kind of physical intervention. And frankly, in my view, it lets people off the hook. It's really easy to just go, oh, Johnny's got ADHD, I don't have to parent him well. Or, oh, well, my dad was bipolar, so that explains why I always lose my temper. And so it's important to really realize that even, for example, on a daily basis or certainly once a week, most of us actually, generally unconsciously, but we actually suppress a biological impulse toward violence on frustration. We don't lash out. We may read someone the riot act verbally or flip them the bird on the freeway or something, but we don't go violent on them like probably would happen in a hunter-gatherer culture, 80,000 years ago. Okay, so biology is not destined. All right, next main point, the representation of social information. That's kind of fancy language, but it's kind of important to realize this. So here's how it works. So how did your mate, how did your deadbeat ex, whatever, how did your wayward kids, whatever, how did your parents, how did George Bush, how did anyone develop their object relations? Okay? What I mean by that is, how did they develop their way of being in relationships, their model? I'll explain object relations a little later. How do we develop our models and ways of being in relationships? How do we learn how to be in relationships? Okay. So the way it works is that, first of all, an infant, it's interesting, the peak number of synapses in the brain, in the gray matter, is about at age 2, 2.5. A 2.5-year-old, ballpark, has about 3 to 4 times as many synapses as you do today. Isn't that interesting? And a lot of what happens is a kind of neural Darwinianism, okay, where there's a use it or lose it dynamic, that if you use it, you keep it, and if you don't use it, those neurons and those connections wither and kind of fade away. And so children are totally on the fast track of learning. They're doing a lot of object learning, like how to grasp, how to reach, how to crawl, how to walk. On the other hand, if you really think about it, I don't know how many of you are parents, how many of you have raised, let's say, an infant? Okay, more than half the room. You know what I'm talking about? The truth is they're kind of blobby for the first few years, or the first 9 months or so. Before they can crawl. But they're 9 months. And think about the difference between a 9-month-old and a newborn. For one, that 9-month-old has experienced what's called the advent of intersubjectivity. That 9-month-old can actually register the fact that there's a being behind your eyes that's distinct from his or her own being. And that the being behind your eyes has feelings and intentions that may match or not, may not match his or her own. That's a remarkable accomplishment. Think about how nuanced and communicative a 9-month-old is, or a 1-month-old. They're amazingly communicative. I did my dissertation on 15-month-olds, and they're not quite at language. Infancy means without speech. That's the meaning of that word. It's fascinating, actually. But wowie zowie. And these kids are still pretty inept in terms of motor skills, right, at 15 months old. On the other hand, boy, are they socially adept. we're doing massive amounts of social learning the first years of our life. We certainly continue throughout adulthood, but a lot of the 0 to 3 period is about social learning. It's about relationship skills and models and how to be. So how do we do that? What the brain does is it tends to represent information like little movies in kind of schematic narrative structures. If you've ever seen a storyboard for a movie or like a cartoon structure, it's very schematic. You know, Bruce Willis, like stick figure with gun. That's a frame. And then second frame, car exploding, right? And then third frame, Bruce running toward the explosion, something. That's like a storyboard. That's an event. That's a narrative. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So the flow of experience is on a temporal trajectory. This is actually important because this is how a child figures out cause and effect. Aha. If event A at the beginning, at time one, is pretty reliably followed by event B, okay, then if I want event B, make sure event A happens. Or if event A happens and I do X at time two and I get result B at time three and I like B, keep doing X. Alternately, if event A happens at time one and I do X at time two and I get result Z at time three, like, ouch, don't do X. See? It's the temporal lining. So that's what we're doing when we're kids. We're forming these representations across time in a narrative structure. Hey, perfect timing. Come on in. I think we have seats, and I know there are more out there. Okay. So these representations of individual episodes, which then get indexed across hundreds, thousands of episodes, form these kind of condensed models of relationship. All right? So in other words, what I observed when I did my research, come on in, I know there are chairs, some up here, I know there, you might have to give up your coffee table. They'll come up here, plenty of seats. And we may need to turn the aircon on. I can kind of feel the force. Would you be willing to do that? Do you want to, either one? Yeah, I think both knobs all the way to the right, especially the one on the right. That's it. You got it all the way. That's good. Okay, so my point is this. A lot of times parents will, when they're raising kids, or when we were little kids, first off, very often, parents say one thing and do another. And they sincerely think they're doing a certain kind of parenting. Or the people we're in relationship these days. Like, you know, your boss reads everybody the Riot Act, people are kind of reeling, and he goes, like, what? I let go of it. You know, like, well, yeah, the bomb went off, and we're all, like, blown away. Like, huh, really? Wow, I had no idea, you know? When I did my dissertation, I observed 20 moms with 20 15-month-olds, 10 boys, 10 girls, and videotaped them, and then watched that videotape for hours and hours and hours. And the point of it all is that you see people who sound nice, who do a dozen things an hour that are needlessly controlling or dismissive or punishing. Or neglectful. They just tune out. It's the little things. Yeah, sometimes it's the big things. But for most people, it's the little things times 10,000 that really, really add up and form these fundamental paradigms. So you might really. So that's why I think actually these days, because we can't do anything about the past, all we can do now is to tend to the causes of what will make things better in the future, including the causes of shifts of representations of the past in our own brains, in our own minds. We can do that. So I find really useful to think to yourself, huh, so let's say you have someone who's in a relationship with you and you're trying to improve that relationship. Think to yourself, how many interactive episodes a day, ballpark, do I have with that person? 10, 100, it's probably somewhere in between those two numbers just to scale it. Call it 10. So of 10 interactions a day with my teenage son, or 10 interactions a day with my wife, or my coworker who's kind of cranky, from their perspective, what percentage of those interactions are positive, neutral, or negative? Okay? Now, let's make it up. Let's say 20% are positive from their standpoint, 20% are neutral, or 30% are neutral from their standpoint, but 50% are negative. OK? Okay? History forms expectation. Best predictor of the future is the past. Okay? If you're with someone and their experience is, hey, come on in, just rolling, that there's a 4 in 5 chance that their next interaction with you will be either painful or kind of a nothing, why would they initiate an interaction? See what I mean? In other words, if you're going to pull the slot machine and you know that half the time it's going to hurt, 30% of the time you're going to get nothing, and 20% of the time it'll pay off, how likely are you to reach in and pull that lever the next time? So it's the little things over and over and over again that make a big difference, which on the other hand gives us fantastic opportunity to start making a difference today. All right? To start making a difference today. This for me was a very haunting question when I asked it about my kids. You know, I started thinking about this when they were pretty young, but still, you know, although I think I was really a very nurturing dad because I was already reading this stuff and really thinking about it and very motivated. But anyway, it was poignant and generated a certain amount of regret and remorse, like, wow. So I started thinking a lot about their experience of interactions over and over and over again and try to increase the pile of positive interactions compared to merely neutral ones. Okay? All right. So now a couple examples. One representation of interactions, one little model, might be one of mom when she's in a good mood and she smells this way. And a different representation of time with mom is when she smells that way, when she's got alcohol in her breath. And you don't really know what that smell is when you're 1 year old or even often 8 years old. But you know that it just doesn't feel good with mom when there's that smell in her breath. And so then, hypothetically, you know, 40 years later, you got a partner who likes to drink socially, but, you know, under control, it's all cool, but there's just something about it that really bothers you, for example. Okay? And so then you have to obviously deal with the juggling act. You know, I've got this representation of mom in this way, that representation of mom in that way. You know, the mark of a mature mind is to be able to form an integrated and complex representation about important other people. Rather than it's either good mom, bad mom, it's one mom with good and bad qualities inside her. I think of the mosaic. You know, most people actually are, you know, at least 80-10-10. In other words, 80 good, 10 neutral, 10 bad. If not, honestly, you know, 80, 18, and 2. You know, 80 good, 18 neutral, 2 problematic. Right? It's useful to think about that way with other people. Okay? So now I want to talk about, now I'm starting to move into the money part of the talk. Here we go. So this is just foundational. So now, how do these representations get generalized? What are some major patterns? And I'm going to talk about several major patterns that I see writ large in daily life. I think I see this in my daily life, and I see it in myself, and I think about it. So basically, these representations, if you think of it, have a three-part structure. And this is a great way to be mindful of your own experience in daily life. There's the self. There's what's called the object. And I'm sure, Deanna, we can get more chairs. Plus, we have a few more chairs, too, floating around. It's good. You okay? Okay, great. So, self, right, me, object, you, them, and what's called a linking affect, kind of the feeling tone. So, for example, I'll just actually read this because it's clear, I think. Well, actually, let me back up. Now, an object can be anything. It could be an individual parent. It could be mom. Or it could be mom when she smells like this and mom when she smells like that. Or an object, frankly, could be a part of a person, a breast, for example, or other parts of the body that shall be nameless. Or an object could be a class of people, Republicans, men, policemen, women, right? Democrats, Muslims. It's an object. Okay? So now, for example, a person's object relations, let's say with a nurturing parent, would include one, a representation of the self, let's say herself, as lovable and worthy. That's how I feel, lovable and worthy. A representation of the parent as present, emotionally available, attentive, caring, helpful. Okay? Right? And that's the object. And then a feeling that connects us both of positive expectations, desires for closeness, contentment, etc. See how that works? And you, on the other hand, you can imagine an unpleasant kind of situation on the other side. Now, the other interesting deal, so the thing is this also, any one of those three things associates the other two. So if you're with a certain kind of a person, let's say you grew up in a family where your dad was loving but kind of a classic, stern, detached authority figure. And so now you're you ended up feeling kind of scared and nervous with sort of unrequited, unfulfilled longings for closeness and approval, especially approval. That's how you ended up. And so you felt kind of small and less than and relatively weak and powerless and unwanted. And there are emotions of both desire for connection and resentment and anger. Okay? Now you go to work. Or you meet your kid's fiancé's dad. Right? And a perfectly fine person who just fits the paradigm. And let's remember, a lot of this got laid down in the mind of a young child who is very bright, let's say, usually, but was young and simplistic and concrete and lost a lot of nuances. I don't know if you've had the experience of reading a fairly sophisticated novel when you're young and then later when you're an adult. It's quite striking what you realize. Wow, I had no idea all these nuances. Okay, so let's say you meet that person. So, boom, you encounter the object. What happens next? The other two get stirred up through association. You find yourself feeling weirdly tongue-tied and kind of dissociated and spacey and disengaged and kind of cautious. And you feel you don't like the guy right off the top. You kind of don't like him, but you want his approval. It's weird. So you find yourself overstating your accomplishments, but internally you're thinking, you asshole, right? And then you go walk away, and your partner or your kid, whose fiancé's parents who you're trying to make nice with, says, Mom, Dad, what? Like, what was wrong with Joe, right? See what I mean? That's how that gets stirred up. Okay, and so now let's see. Another really key point besides this associational process is that any one of these three elements, especially the characters, any one of these characters can be internalized in our own mind. What I mean by that is that, let's say she represents her dad or he represents his dad in that way. Suddenly, 30 years later, you find yourself acting like dad when you're in a similar kind of situation, right? With your kids. I've had that experience. I find myself saying stuff, I'm like, whoa! I didn't like that when my dad said it. Why am I saying it? It's like you're on autopilot. It's just, you know, through just association. And so we can internalize that. And this actually gets very interesting when I go to the next level of sophistication. Okay, so these are the structures. So think object relations, right? Self, object, and links. Okay, next, rewards. This is not just abstract. We do this this is pot and passionate. This is the stuff of literature. This is the stuff of opera where everybody's dead on stage at the end. This is the stuff of Shakespeare. This is TV. This is Baghdad. This is the real world. These patterns in the mind. These dynamics. And for most people, it's completely outside of awareness. You know, they just know that they keep choosing the same person over and over again and it all goes bad. Or they choose good people, but they create endless trouble because they imagine things are bad when they're actually not. You know, on and on it goes. They feel subtly small. They are on a quest for certain kinds of rewards that they didn't get in their younger years, including their 20s. They keep going, trying to get blood from a stone. They're still on the quest for the grail. See, these are real things. So rewards. For one, in the brain, if we get rewarded, it feels good. We get the surge of dopamine. Dopamine's a great neurotransmitter. You know, for example, cocaine binds to dopamine receptors to kind of give you a certain sense of the impact of dopamine. On the other hand, another reward is oxytocin. That's what's released a lot when women are nursing babies. Men have oxytocin too. Women have testosterone, men have estrogen, right? It's kind of all mixed, not in the same proportions to body weight, obviously, different hormones, but we have these hormones in ourselves. So there are these deep reward systems that go on in the brain related to relationships, which then get elaborated, da-da-da-da-da, with a whole lot of beliefs and so forth. So, quick question. How are you doing heat-wise and air-wise? Bad? Yeah. Hey, Deanna, just crank it up. Okay? Let's go. What? Oh, yeah. Former camp counselor Rick. Okay, I love it. Oh, that's really going to put it up. Yeah?
I have a question.
Question.
Which refers to the very first part of your lecture. You talked about the proportion of good and ill or evil.
Yeah.
How do you account then for wars?
Huge question. I'm probably going to duck. But, well, so her question was really fast, and then I'm going to keep rolling. You know, I was saying that I think at a personality level, on any given day, Adolf Hitler was a pretty nice guy. Okay? If you have one bad tile, mosaic 100 tiles, let's say, 10 by 10, you could have one bad tile, but you have a person living from that one bad tile who has a lot of power, driven by a lot of fear. And the conditions are ripe. You know, you have the end of World War I setting up the whole rise of Hitler. I realize my parents, you know, talk about weird contingencies. They met in World War II. I would not be here today if some guy had not shot Archduke Ferdinand to trigger World War I. And I bet a lot of you wouldn't be here either. Isn't that the weirdest thing? So that's one side of it. Another is, what's interesting also is that in hunter-gatherer cultures, there seems to be a fair amount of intertribal rivalry as a norm. And a lot of it's ritualistic. But on the other hand, it's not uncommon. Like monkeys, for example, will hunt and kill wandering males from other troops. And but wars are not. Wars are kind of, you know, they're mass. Wars are the result of post-agricultural societies that have city-states. And I don't know. I think that's a long conversation. I think we got two wolves in the heart, one to love and one to hate. And it all depends on which one we feed every day. You know. Okay. So now, attachment theory. How many of you have ever heard of attachment theory? Okay, great. I'm going to do this really fast. This is one of the primary paradigms. You might want to ask yourself, what's my core attachment style when I was young, of the three? And I'll say what they are in a second. And second, where's my attachment style today? All right? So social animals tend to bond with caregivers. Like little baby geese will bond to mama goose. They'll actually imprint on the first creature they see. Have you seen, there's this famous photo of Conrad Lorenz. You can see it on Wikipedia. Being followed as he walks across his yard in, I don't know what, the Netherlands, followed by about 6 or 8 little baby geese. Because he deliberately, when they hatched, he was the guy, he put himself so that he was the first animal they saw. They could care less about their mother goose. They were onto Conrad. All right? Okay, so attachment is very deep. If you think about it, like the family bed, co-sleeping, etc. In evolution, little children that did not intensely want to sleep close to their parents at night got eaten. They didn't pass on their genes. Flip the other way, parents who did not intensely want to be close to their little kids at night, even big little kids, did not have genes that got passed on because those kids got eaten. So there's an intense desire in the attachment structure to be close to the kids. There's a sweet video in the internet, a YouTube clip, I think, of a moose, a mama moose, and mooses, moose. They're really big. They're bigger than deer. Deers are like, I don't know what, like large dogs or something. Moose are huge. And so there's this mama moose with her two baby moose in somebody's backyard, I don't know where, Montana, Canada, with a sprinkler running. So first you see the little kid mooses running in and out of the sprinkler. They're so sweet. Mama moose is after them, though. She's making sure it's all chill. You know, they never go too far away from her, et cetera, et cetera. This is very deep in our structure attachment. Okay, so then us. Basically, a lot of research has shown that there are pretty much essentially three attachment patterns. There's a fourth, but it's pretty rare. And it tends to occur in extremely abusive or difficult situations. The three are basically, one, secure attachment. Two is insecure avoidant. And then the other is called insecure anxious. Let me explain. If you raise a child, a little kid, like 0 to 1.5 years, 0 to 3 certainly, and you're reasonably attentive, reasonably emotionally available, skillful, and so forth, and that's good enough for the temperament of that child. And some kids are pretty low maintenance, whereas other kids are really high maintenance. So you might have to dial up, a parent might have to dial up provision to continue to provide a secure environment for a high needs child. That child can't help it. he, she is, has colic for a long time, can't sleep at night, or is hyperactive, or whatever, okay? Very sensitive child. Or a preemie, came out a month early or 3 months early. You don't know. All right. So the result, though, is that's a child who feels secure in her base or his base. What do you do when you have a secure base? You venture out. There's this fundamental tension in us as animals, whether to approach and go out or come back and hunker down. And survival, adaptation in the wild, is a balance of those two. If you don't go out, you can't find food or a mate. On the other hand, if you go out, you expose yourself to natural hazards and predators. Most animals die in the act of being eaten by another one. It's pretty intense to just think about that one. So, how do you do that? And you can see that dynamic writ small in the life of a toddler in a park. Let's say with mom or dad, ventures out, gets some distance away, depending on the temperament of the kid, pauses and looks back. Are you watching? Is it okay? That's called social signaling. You kind of get that, okay, and then keeps going. But it's almost like you could feel it. There's a bungee cord that connects that kid to that secure base. And you get to a certain point, that kid's going to come back. And then if something new happens, like a stranger approaches, kid will sidle back. Or if the caregiver is distracted and chatting with somebody else, the kid will do something like pick a fight with another kid or come back to get the attention and go out again. There's this dynamic. So if you're secure, you feel like you can come back. Here's the problem, though. If you have a parent, let's say, who's what's called dismissing, who's kind of indifferent, sort of neglectful, doesn't tune into you, doesn't really get your inner world, maybe is well-intended, but is very weak in terms of empathy, that parent is going to give a child those 10,000 little episodes, many of which are just a few seconds long. Some of them are a few minutes long. Most interactive episodes are fairly short. So you got to think again, hey, what happens, in short little moments? I know we have a chair there and a chair there. All right, great. So here's this child who has this natural desire to be close. Little kids need to bond. If they don't bond, they're in trouble in the wild. There are exceptions. On the autistic spectrum, one of the primary problems is that's a child who doesn't seem to bond. And there's some kids who do bond, but then they get kind of flooded with the intensity of the experience, and then they want to pull away after they get a quick refueling. But there's this drivenness in the child to connect. And there's also a lot of desires in the child, besides connecting, to express his or her wants. So we have these two human dynamics, intimacy, connecting, and call it autonomy or self-expression, right? Closeness and expression, like wants or emotions. Then what happens? If the preponderance of the interactions, and again, depending on that child, if you have a child who's more introverted and doesn't care too much about closeness, a parent who's a little dismissing probably isn't going to have that much of an impact. If you've got a child who's has a very alert and socially attuned in and really is reading you and wants that closeness, and maybe also has a lot of need for caregiving because he, she is colicky or whatever, and that child runs into a dismissing parent, boy, that hurts. Hurts 250 times a day, in little moments. So now remember how the narrative structure, right? Time one, time two, times three. If in time one, I want to be close with you, or I want your help, time two, I make a bid. I signal that. I cry, or I smile, or I try to get your attention, or I try to make eye contact. Maybe I call out, whatever it is, or I reach. And then at time three, you, the parent, are tuned out, drunk, upset at your mate, worried about work, overwhelmed with work because you're working so hard, you're whatever it is, a single parent, single mom, whatever the reason is, or your own psychology is that, I'll get to this later, you yourself were raised in a dismissing environment as a kid, and closeness just kind of gives you the willies. For whatever reason, you don't respond, then at time four, what's the experience inside me or you, that infant? Pain. It's frustrating. It's disappointing. There's often their feelings of, what's wrong with me that you're mean to me? If there's a fundamental choice for a kid to make, a little kid especially, am I crazy or are you crazy? They'll almost always pick, I'm crazy. It's the unhealthy choice. unfortunately. Some people are fortunate enough to have realized, I'm not crazy. The problem's over there. I'm okay over here. You know, am I bad or are you bad? It's more like, am I bad or are you bad? Most kids will go to, I'm bad. There must be a reason you're doing this. Because they need to preserve that vision, even if it's tucked away into some little corner of their heart, of the good parent that they can lean on. It's very poignant. It's very deep. Okay? And then here we are with all this, you know, in our 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, or teens. Anyway, okay. On the other hand, what if, same kid, but this parent is kind of flips the coin, in a sense. You know, on even number days is really warm and responsive and nurturing, but on odd number days is kind of punishing and dismissive. And also, often it's a parent who, on the one hand, who kind of uses the child as a means to his or her own ends. There's a sort of a narcissistic flavor in that kind of parent. So the parent may jack the kid up just because the parent wants to feel good, or maybe other people are watching in the store. And then as soon as you're in the parking lot, get in a car. It's like, what? You go back and forth. What does that leave you with? Well, you know, time one, you know, you want something or need something. Time two, you express it. Time three, the parent does this sort of Jekyll and Hyde dynamic. Again, writ small, but 100 or 1,000 times a day. And then at time four, what do you feel? You feel completely spun around. You know, so you start figuring out your strategies. What's the strategy of the child who grows up in that more avoidant attachment framework? You know, the second one I said, not after secure. The strategy is to be in relationships without making demands. And you realize that the price of closeness is to not ask for very much. That's kind of a learning in, let's kind of stand here quietly. They'll let me be here with you, you know? Oh, sorry. I was just doing that little thing at the end. So it's a kind of, I'm going to basically avoid asking for closeness because that leads to pain. I'm going to inhibit the expression of my emotions and my true wants because that leads to pain. And I'm going to learn ways to be in relationship, to be attached, but at an optimal distance. Because if I try to get closer, it starts to hurt. But if I break away, you kind of bam on me because you don't want me to be fully autonomous. That's one way of learning how to be. And you can ask yourself in your own relationships if you yourself notice a subtly increasing resistance, like putting the two north poles of two magnets together as you get closer in, and nervousness and fear. Alternately, do you experience a kind of inhibition on just swinging out, living large, being your full self, expressing authentically, appropriately, and skillfully, but expressing and pursuing your aims, flying as high as you can so that however high you soar, you're not capped by your own limitations or loss of nerve. Right? If you feel any sense of limitation there in either one of those two poles, it's worth looking inside. How was I raised? And, you know, what happened for me? Little detail, attachment generating experiences can arise, can be different depending on the parent. Like a child could be securely attached to dad and insecure, avoidant with mom or whatever, you know, different dynamics. Also, things happen with other kids and then siblings arrive, and there's a lot of complexity here. People can get very reductionistic, actually, about this whole attachment theory stuff, but it's quite powerful. To go the other way, if you're insecure, anxious, your style is kind of interesting. It's one where, on the one hand, you realize that to get attention, you need to kind of have a lot of drama. You know, you need to be either wonderfully great, like straight A's in school, or triple flips on the board, or breaking down, or, you know, something, or intense emotionally. But you're always wondering, when will the shoe drop? You know, when will the next thing happen? So there's a kind of anxiety there. Classically, for me, this last point makes it quite real. When you study this in the lab, they do this in a certain paradigm called the strange situation. They take a kid and they put them in a lab with like these seven steps, basically, or close to that. And at one of them, the parent leaves the room. So now, secure child, parent leaves the room, kid is upset. Where'd my base go? I need my base. So they get upset and they're angry and they're grumpy. And the parents out of the room for like 2 minutes. But this is that's a long time when you're 18 months old. And then let's say it's mom. Mom comes back and the kid spikes in his upset. You left me, right? Wah! And then mom goes, oh, sorry, man. You know, hug. And the kid settles down quickly and goes back to playing. Right? That's a securely attached paradigm. And you can imagine the equivalent of that in important relationships. In other words, that's a repairable breach. Repair skills are so profoundly important. For me, you want to be in a good relationship with someone, play your best odds strategy with selection. Pick a good person. That's huge. But after that, for me, it's all about learning curve and repair skills. Does this person have a learning curve? Is it like flat or shallow or steep or negative? And can we repair? All right, that's what you want to really see. Okay. On the other hand, let's say insecure, anxious. In this case, child's really clingy while mom's in the room, and the child's constantly scanning, is mom going to leave? A lot of vigilance there. Okay. Oh. I'll get to that. Okay, I'll do it this way. So I'm inverting my order. I'm talking insecure anxious now. So the insecure anxious kid is always tracking mom. Are you here? Okay, good. So you think about people who have kind of clinging behaviors. They always feel nervous. What's going to happen when you leave? Need a lot of phone calls. I'm thinking of you. I'm coming home. There's a certain nervousness there. By the way, for me, all these patterns are very normal, and they deserve tons of compassion, tons of self-acceptance, and tons of support and healing. They're all manageable. I'll just leave it that I did not grow up, securely attached in my own way. So, okay. So anyway, pretty okay. My wife may differ, but anyway. Okay, my point is that then when mom leaves, wow, that kid is upset, this anxious, insecure child, because it's like, let's say it's a boy, he has no resources inside. It's like, whoa. It's total meltdown. And then when mom finally comes back, he's inconsolable. And he does this very interesting thing. He clutches at her, but he pinches her. It's clinging reproach. The extreme of it, certain kind of relationship paradigms, I think of it as like napalm. It's glue and gasoline. They cling and they burn. See what I mean? It's like that kind of a person. And you can imagine extremes of that. Okay. Now, the insecure avoidant kid's very interesting. Mom leaves. So first of all, the kid plays in the room as if mom's not in the room. Because remember, the price of relationship is minimal demand and an optimal distance. When mom leaves the room, the kid doesn't even notice it. He's over in the corner doing his little block thing in the experimental room. Everybody's watching him, video cameras. But they also have him hooked up. They have this pulse monitor on him. They have this skin, galvanic skin response thing, dealy bob, like a lie detector. Mom leaves the room. Whew, his needle pegs the bar. His pulse jumps 10 to 20 beats a second, or a minute rather, 10 to 20 beats a minute. His skin is all twitchy. He's stressed and rattled. Mom left the room. But is he going to show it? No. Because showing it, what? Leads to pain. Right? So then, mom comes back a couple minutes later, comes back, they reunite. He acts like, cool, kind of glances at her. But when she comes back in the room, his pulse rate jumps again. He kind of jumps, settles down a little bit, then mom returns, jumps again. But he doesn't do anything. He doesn't go to her for consolation, to be soothed or anything, because asking too much, boom, leads to exile. See? Deep learning. Now, I'm doing it kind of extremely and a little simplistically, but you can see the dynamics of this writ large in lots and lots and lots of human relationships. Okay? Great. Now, I want to say one last thing, and then I'll be quiet, and we're good with time. I'm happy. Okay. Now, I want to translate these. I want to say two things. First, there are some correlations that are generational. In other words, there's a better than chance likelihood that an insecure, avoidant child will grow up to be a dismissing parent who has insecure, avoidant children. And there's a better than even chance that an insecure, anxious child will grow up to be a, I forget the exact term for it, it's kind of called the Jekyll and Hyde pattern, and have an insecure, anxious child. But it's really important to realize those linkages are fairly small fractions of all the factors that determine outcome. And you'll sometimes read people who just say categorically, you know, it goes from here to here to here. Well, the actual impact of the attachment experiences you had when you're a kid and the attachment style your kid has is maybe like, I don't know what, on the average it might be like 10 to 20% of the factors that influence that result reside in your own attachment style as a kid. So you don't want to make too much of a deal out of it, but you want to think about it. You know, if you were raised in a certain kind of a way, remember, we've internalized these parents. We've internalized them. We internalized mom, dad, and part of mom and part of dad. We internalized good mom and bad mom, good dad and bad dad, you know, drinking mom and sober mom, et cetera, et cetera. And we can find ourselves enacting that with our own kids. Okay? So far? One last thing. Now, it's interesting that as an adult, there are some basic attachment relationship models that map pretty well to childhood, but not always. So I'm explaining. One is called schizoid. Schizoid, basically, the schizoid style basically looks a lot like insecure avoidant attachment brought into adulthood. This is the kind of person, and we all have these tendencies. The question is, how captured are you by them, and how extreme are they in your own case? This is the kind of person who, on the one hand, as I said earlier, likes to preserve an optimal distance. So they tend to orbit the object. And one way to think of it is that the sense of self is relatively small and the object is big. You know, and as long as I remain small and I don't land on you, we're okay. So one very interesting thing to ask yourself when you're in relationships is, to what extent are your behaviors self-referenced or object-referenced? What I mean by that is that obviously there's a place for virtue and compassion, loving kindness and love in important relationships, generosity, cooperative altruism, and so forth. Okay. But, you know, on the other hand, I've found a lot in intimate relationships, people have a hard time. It's like you can't see the stars in the daylight because the sun outshines them. They like have a hard time really identifying their own true core and their own true needs when they're around another person, because that object is just too big. It's an interesting thing to imagine, like, how can I put it? How would I be with you if I was just being me and I wasn't doing anything based on what your response might be? And I was doing that constrained appropriately by my ethics and by my kindness. But I wasn't constrained by any kind of scripting of the anticipation of your response in my mind. What's that like? It's very free. It's really, and what's interesting, sometimes you try to do it, you realize how hard it is actually. It's like, wow, these scripts go deep. All right. One of the classic, by the way, I should have said this earlier, forms of these scripts that you see in relationships is in what was called transactional analysis. You have the, whatever, is the child, the inner child, and then you have the critical parent and the nurturing parent. Or another formulation of that was very interesting. You have the victim, the persecutor, and the protector. And, or perpetrator, rescuer. I have observed a lot, as a quick sidebar, I know there'll be people in this room that will go, wow, that's really interesting when I say this, which is, usually the action is with the failed protector. The perpetrator, the persecutor, the asshole, you just figure, man, that was my stepdad, he was such an asshole, or that was my mom's boyfriend. But it's to the parent, the other person in the system, why didn't you stick up for me? Why didn't you understand? Why didn't you listen? Why didn't you take my hints? Wasn't it obvious to you? Why didn't you step in for me? And then nowadays in life, very often, what we want, because we're adults now, and it's not always appropriate, even though it's understandable, we want other people to swoop in and give us the kind of advocacy and protection and solidarity and sisterhood, brotherhood, whatever, today, that we should have had as a kid. But actually today, alas, adulthood a lot doesn't work that way. Yes, there's a place for community, alliances, and so forth, but there's also a place where we just have to stick up for ourselves unilaterally without being object referenced. You know, speaking our truth, communicating for ourselves, regardless of whatever the response might be, not doing it to get a certain kind of response, because that makes our success then contingent on what that other person does. And suddenly we're back in, you know, childhood again, where we're so dependent on the other person for getting our needs met. Okay? So there's this schizoidal style. The other side of the schizoidal style, though, is inhibition on self-expression and expression of the true self. True feelings, true desires, true goals. How do you feel about pursuing your own true goals? How do you feel about just letting it be known who you are, how you are, what you care about, and where you're going? You know, a lot of us, there's some inhibitions there about that. Okay? So that leads to this kind of orbiting. Never lands on planet other, right? Nor breaks out of orbit. Escape velocity, free. Right? Okay. Another major style is narcissistic. Wow, I could talk a lot about narcissism, normal narcissism. Basically, it's a situation of growing up in childhood, classically, where narcissistic supplies were delivered and then withheld. Delivered, withheld. They get you interested. You like the taste. Ooh, yum, yum. Oop, no more cookies. Right? In other words, often, you know, how many of you have read Miller's book, Alice Miller's Drama of the Gifted Child? That's one of those awesome classics. It's a little heavy lifting, but just read the first two chapters in the introduction. It's short, actually. Way through the psychoanalytic language, dialect, and it's brilliant, actually. The point there, if we're narcissistically loaded in themes in our life, we're looking for prizing, attunement, like-mindedness, and empathy, right? And whereas if you're schizoidal, you're more looking for safety, not being invaded, you know, and not having too much asked of you, those tendencies. And now, a lot of us have both those tendencies, but you can ask yourself, where are you with that? It's natural, of course, children have normal narcissistic needs, for empathy, attunement, and prizing. If you get those needs met, and some kids have more needs than others, depending on their temperament, which is just, you know, the way it is. If you get those narcissistic needs met, your heart fills up, right? That big swimming pool we're all born with, you know, the hole in the heart gets filled in. Whoop, it's great. So we don't go through life trying to refill this huge hole. On the other hand, if our normal narcissistic needs don't get met very well in childhood, depending on our nature, we go through life trying to fill that hole in the heart. One of the good news things is that, pardon me, if we have more narcissistic needs, we can actually internalize rewards to fill that hole in the heart. We can take in prizing. We can take in love. We could take in empathy through taking in the good. This inner skill I talk about a lot, and you can get the download from our website, Taking in the Good, where you really internalize positive experiences. I actually spent about 2 to 3 years that are sort of notorious among my friends, where people would compliment me, I'd ask for more. They'd say, "Oh, that was good. You know, I liked what you wrote. What'd you like about it?" You know? But I did it deliberately. And the question is, when we get these narcissistic supplies, because most of us have some kind of hole in the heart, right? What do we do with them? Do we take them in, or do we brush them off? Are we endlessly craving? You know, or are we actually trying to be kind to ourselves today in a way that maybe we should have received when we were young to really, really soak that stuff in? And when you're with someone, I'll get to that in a second, the other side of it, from a schizoidal standpoint, what really helps is to learn to tolerate closeness. And we're going to do exercises after the break, which will come soon. Where we get more and more comfortable just feeling the intensity of it and the vulnerability of it and the of it. And just notice it's okay. We go on being. The thing about these object relations, which is amazing, is they're usually grounded very deeply in 2 to 3 randomly selected people. How many of us chose our parents? Other than some kind of karmic reincarnation theory. Who knows? I don't know. I'm agnostic about it myself. I think there actually is some interesting evidence for it. But that said, you know, there are these two, three, four random people. You know, have you ever done this thing, like if you were stuck at a train station or at a party with your mom or your dad or your uncle, would you actually want to be friends with them? You know, or your sibs? That's a very interesting question. You don't have to answer it. But now, in adulthood, holy moly, we are with different people, often much better selected, okay? We have many more resources to deal with breaches, and we have better repair skills, all that. That's great. What people do lands on us, so we're much less vulnerable to it because we're not so dependent on them. We have many more options, and we have much more levels to our psychology that it just kind of lands in. It's like a bowling ball in a puddle. He just blows it out of the water. A bowling ball in Lake Tahoe. A bowling ball in Lake Tahoe. What F? You know, we're older now. We're Lake Tahoe. They're the bowling ball. See what I mean? And so we kind of overgeneralize from these very specific patterns we learned as kids. And we then generalize to all our relationships. So one of the things to realize is that, okay, I can be close. Let's say I'm working on my schizoidal issues around closeness. And it's okay. The same thing, the thing that happened over and over again when I'm a kid doesn't happen today. They don't smack me when I want to get close. They don't, they're not mean to me. They don't put me down. They don't shame me. They're okay, right? Wow, right? Or to go the other way, to express the true self authentically, emotionally, directionally, like what our aims are, and then realize, wow, a shaming attack does not follow today. Actually, people dig it when I kind of let it rip and speak my truth from my heart. Wow. See what I mean? We take that in. So these are really great opportunities. I'll actually say one last thing, and then we'll do questions, and we'll take a break, okay? I really appreciate your indulgence. I really turned on the fire hose, didn't I? You were great. You know, you're like right there, so I really appreciate it. Okay, the question is now, what to do with your partner? And then we'll get into the real meat, you know. Be nice if your partner's in the room. But if you're with someone, so let's say you're with someone who has some narcissistic needs. First off, they're often kind of disguised. You just get a feeling, like they want to be stroked all the time. Maybe it comes across a little bit that way. What's a common response? Step away, right? It's a natural response, isn't it? It's the wrong response. You know, the best response is feed the hungry bee. I love that phrase from the electric Kool-Aid acid test, you know, Ken Kesey, Merry Pranksters, feed the hungry bee. Just feed them. Now, in a humorous way, based on feeding them, say, by the way, I want you to really take this in, you know, and really deliver the acknowledgement and the heartfelt communication to them, but expect them to be a grown-up about it and to actually take it in and not turn into a junkie. I need a good mix, you know, but actually make it a part of themselves so it goes in the tissues of their whole being, right? And it's especially often hard for more schizoidal types to realize the narcissistic supplies that a more narcissistically loaded person needs. I can speak from personal experience. Because I actually have both these tendencies in myself, and I realize that, so I have both of them. So my point is that, because often, if you think of it, a schizoidal person doesn't want to get too close. And so if another person wants something from you, that's a yellow light right there. Whoa, danger ahead. They want something from me. Wanting things from me leads to closeness. Closeness leads to pain. Okay, right off the top, number one. Number two, if you're complimenting somebody or delivering narcissistic supplies to them, you're often getting really close. You really feel it. Like, whoa, orange light. You know, this is really feeling creepy. See, so there's some tendencies often in more schizoidal types. And you see that in couples a lot. He or she, let's say it's a kind of classic he. He looks all, I see this a lot in my world, he's kind of got his act together, but truly, he wants strokes, okay? He wants to feel that he's recognized, that he's seen, he's cherished, and including he's seen as a lover, not just a provider and a co-mortgage holder. Okay. She's kind of doing her grind. She's working her life, and he's like, grow out, take care of your own needs. Right? And it's even offensive, you know. The genders flip. I just did it this way because I've been thinking of a couple recently. But anyway, that's a problem in the relationship. Okay. So that's one thing. The second thing that I learned painfully was that to a schizoidal person, bids for closeness are threatening.
Or what?
Threatening. So if you want to get, let's say you're wanting more love from that person, or you're just trying to connect, You know what I mean? You're doing a connecting thing. Like, you're just trying to connect. Your desire to connect makes them uncomfortable. Because connecting leads to pain. You're going past this threshold, optimal distance. It's like, if you're no closer than this and no farther away from that, we're good. Right? See what I mean? But if I get more than this close to you or more than that away from you, it's a problem. See how that is? And so I used to think that everybody wanted to be close. Doesn't everybody want to be close? No! A lot of people really don't. They want to be this close, you know? You know, it's kind of like, hi, how are you? You know, it's like that. Okay? So it's really, for me, useful to kind of understand different types of people, to realize who you're working with, realize these tendencies in yourself. There's tremendous plasticity in the brain, tremendous opportunities to change these dynamics and try new things. Okay? All right? Great. So, questions, comments, then we'll take a break.
When you were talking about...
Loud.
Well, when you were talking about filling the other one's needs, like, I need some narcissistic goodies or something, and the other person gives it the same love.
What?
Narcissistic supplies.
Right.
I'll restate the question. I have a big voice,
and
yeah.
And you want the person to really take it in.
Yeah.
Just mention about when they've internalized that aggressive parent or whatever, but sometimes instead of not seeing that there's a shameful remark or a resentment, it can be like... misinterpreted due to the set.
That's true.
Person, either way.
Yeah. So her question was, keep in mind that if you're trying to, in effect, nurture someone who you could see could use some supplies, I think it was a supply train, you know, like Conestoga wagons coming across the prairies and stuff like that, deliver the supplies. I'll tell my wife, honey, I need a refueling, you know. It's like people need intimacy pit stops. Sometimes people need, you know, narcissism pit stops. So, okay. But what happens when that person is, for whatever reason, kind of trained to push away what they need most? Isn't that human and poignant and real? What do you do? A, the truth is you can't micromanage everything. You know, and there are a lot of complexities to these theories and whatnot, and you can kind of get your head all turned around. The way I look at it is all you can do is what you can do. You can just only tend to the causes. You cannot control the results. So to tend to the causes skillfully, you might kind of observe the person. You might look for ways just to deliver compliments in a more detached and impersonal way. I find it really works for me to deliver acknowledgments to people or to talk about what's happening in a relationship in a very factual way. Like factually, I complimented my daughter earlier today, you know, but I just factually... she does those things that you really want someone who's working for you to do. She's responsible. She thinks ahead. She does more than you ask for. And she exceeds your expectations when she delivers the product. Like for her, for me, it's some graphic work. And for me, it was just factual. And what was so powerful about it was I have a business background. And for me, I was just dead on the fact of it. That, I find, is often a good way to communicate with people. Okay, another question or comment? Yeah.
Well, in a relationship, you want reciprocity and mutuality.
Yep. Well, actually,
I mean, often in a relationship that I want my narcissist. Well, then they want their narcissist.
Yeah, yeah.
I want my first.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
That's a great question. So, question being, how do you deal with? Yeah, with mutuality and reciprocity. And when, what if you have two hungry bees? Mm-hmm. And you really see that with parents and young kids. They're both fried and they're running on fumes, each of them, and they're looking for a fill up from the other. And it's kind of a bad fit. That's why, to me, you know, it's really important to raise kids in a village, right? Except not a ghost town, which is status quo in a lot of communities, unfortunately. So what to do? You know, I think, first of all, naming what's happening is great. And finding language for it. Not therapizing our mates. But for me, we're past the point. Psychology is about 100 years old. It's come into the culture, at least for me, long enough that people can actually talk about it in plain English. And there's a basis for it in the culture. Dr. Phil, AA, you know, Oprah, thank God for Oprah, etc. You know, a lot of good stuff is introduced. Just kind of talk a little bit. Beyond that, I try whenever I can. I find this a good strategy. I suck it up and I deliver the goods first. And I do it out of self-interest because I've really come to appreciate That's the. Oh, sorry. I totally appreciate you willing to let us all stay cool. I was just saying that in a situation where they have needs and you have needs, what do you do when you have two hungry bees? For me, the best odds strategy is to deliver the goods yourself at first, unilaterally, even in the face of provocation. Keep being a good person for some period of time that's reasonable, X. Not years, certainly. Maybe a month. Maybe, for me, a few weeks, if only a few days. My personal experience is that in a high conflict situation, if one person just takes a big breath and maybe a Valium. No, I was joking about the Valium. Anyway, just takes a big breath and says, okay, I'm going to maximally deliver on whatever's reasonable in their grievances with me for 3 days in a row. And I'm going to behave well for 3 days in a row. Often you can transform a relationship. 3 days. And then at the end of the 3 days, maybe you talk to the other person and you say, okay, this for me is a self-interest part. I've taken the high road. I've been cool. You got to admit it. Facts, right? The facts are ABC. It's for real. Most people are pretty cooled out after 3 days. You say, and the one thing I'd really love from you from now on is, would you be willing to do this? What do you think? And then we can talk. But for me, that's kind of high strategy, high odds. Okay.
Could you talk now or later about someone that is very, very high need and yet unable, not out of any lack of love, but just unable to give back because of, I'm not talking about an intimate relationship, I'm talking about friendship, mm-hmm. where you see the person's need for narcissistic supply is extremely high, extremely a lot of the time, but very unable to reciprocate at all.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk about tools like that. Are there tools for that kind of situation?
Yeah. Why don't I answer that question, and then let's take a break.
Okay.
We'll turn on the aircon fully, and then we'll just really, we'll make it work. Okay. So the question was, what do you do when it's kind of a one-way street?
Yeah.
What do you do when you can deliver to them, and they're really hungry, but they can't respond? I think there are different things you do, and it depends on who is that person in your life. Is it your mom? Is it your dad? Is it your mother-in-law? Whatever. You think about that. I try to study the person a little bit in my mind, and I kind of try to figure out what's up. Internally, I just think about them a little bit. Mm-hmm. In the shower, driving a couple minutes, three, doesn't mean you're writing your master's thesis about them. And then you try to figure out what's going on here. That's one. Two, I watch what happens when I give them supplies. Do they actually take it in? Like a lot of people, my observation, don't actually take it in. They keep it in the mud room or in their mind, as it were, and it sits there, but it never goes into the living room, let alone the inner sanctum of the house, of the mind. And then, so then I might talk with them about that. I might tell them something straight, I find it really works to be very authentic, to drop down into a very real felt sense of the good person that's over there, and to feel it. Like, honestly, I bet everyone in this room could just take a big breath, look around the room, and could go face by face by face and get how that's actually a good person, with knowing very little. And definitely true if you know them well. They may have problems, they may not be perfect, but they're a good person. And if you're in your heart, in the truth of them being a good person, the fact, and you communicate that fact, golly, is that powerful. When was the last time you were on the receiving end of someone who is absolutely grounded in their truth, of the fact that you were a good person, and communicated that absolutely affirmatively to you? They had complete certainty that you are a good person. I don't know. That's a very powerful communication to be on the receiving end of. And it can be very quick. It's often strongest if it's hit and run. I blew my daughter away today. I'm so happy. I had this off-the-cuff interaction. I could just tell she was blown out that I just landed on her with this acknowledgement. Partly because I was fed up with someone else that was doing something for me in a work world. And she's 18. What a contrast to this older person. Louder?
Yeah.
Hell. So I'm almost done. The other thing I want to say about that, and then maybe we should take a break, I don't know, unless it's really germane. Let me finish on this, is that then I find you know, honestly, I kind of shrink the relationship to the scale I can trust. Because if you're, how can I put it, if your relationship is bigger than you can really trust the other person, that's unsafe for you. And if it's smaller than you can really trust the other person, that's a lost opportunity. So if what I can really do is I can trust the person to have pleasant 15-minute chats with me every 6 weeks, then that's the scale of our relationship. But if, on the other hand, I keep experiencing that I want to connect and I want to get back more than a really thin soup, and I keep feeling like you're kind of a psychic vampire, you just, what's that sucking sound, you know, et cetera, et cetera, then I'm like, we're going to shrink this relationship, especially if I go through one or two cycles of trying to repair it. That's me. Okay, Chris, then the break.
I just wanted to say that today is Stephanie's 16th birthday, and I think it's really cool that she's here, and if all of us have been in this room when we were 16, we'd probably be way far ahead of the game. So I hope everybody says happy birthday to her before the break.
Happy birthday, Stephanie. We will not sing to you. I hate it when people sing to me in restaurants. So you may love it, but I'm going to project me on you. But thank you. So, wow, thanks, Ma. Well, okay, good. All right, you guys. So you've been great. So let's take an uber quick break, okay, because I want to reserve time for some exercises. All right, 10 minutes. So how about we start at 8:30. The Buddha picked one. He didn't pick